Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show. Each week, we feature different topics concerning issues that sometimes can be difficult to talk about. These issues concern children and adults who may be autistic, have Asperger's, or have mental disorders of any kind. We will discuss law enforcement and how they interact with these persons. Now, let's start the show. Good evening, everyone. This is Jenny White from the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show. I am an author of children's books, and if you have that special person that you're looking for something to put in their stocking this Christmas, I have a surprise for Junior with the Junior Rabbit series. I have Looney the Loon and the Littered Lake, and with the Junior Rabbit series, there's Junior Rabbit Learns About Christmas. So I have three books. You can purchase one, two, or all three. You can purchase them by calling 989-906-1689. They make great stocking stuffers. Tonight we'll be talking to a young lady who's the clinical director at the Children's Care Center. Her name is Crystal Coleman, and I'd like her to introduce herself right now. Crystal, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
I want to thank you, first of all, for joining us for the show. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you this evening?
I'm fine. Crystal, can you give us a little information and tell us who Crystal Coleman is?
Sure. I am a clinical director at the Children's Center. The Children's Center is an outpatient mental health facility in Wayne County. It's located in Detroit, Michigan. We see children there who have been diagnosed or are showing signs of having either a mental illness or an intellectual developmental disability. We provide services for children of all ages. We actually start working with mothers during pregnancy if there are any concerns with her ability to care for the child because of maybe previous experiences of becoming a mother and some difficulties in that area, or if there are any medical or mental health issues going on with the mom that may potentially affect the baby that she's carrying. So we always say that we start with children at age zero because of that. And we can now actually see our clients up through the age of 21. Michigan has finally allowed us to keep what we consider youth to be transitioning into adulthood beyond 18 through the age of 21.
That's really interesting. I know that in the state of Michigan, special ed students can be educated until they're 26, but I didn't know about the health thing until they're 21, so that's kind of good. Matter of fact, that's very good.
It's that same special ed law that allowed us to sort of take that action. It actually just went into place over the past month or two that it became official that we could do that. Yeah, so we're really excited about it.
Okay, so you say you help mothers while the child is in the womb?
Yes.
Is it something that they're having physical problems with?
Sometimes. The program and the services is called Infant Mental Health. A lot of the parents who we see, they may have a mental illness themselves. And some medications are not recommended to be taken during pregnancy, like any other medication, you know, that you may be taking for a physical health reason. So during pregnancy, in addition to additional stressors, the body changes, and maybe having to have changes in medication if a mother is carrying a child, we can help with therapy, with support services. And so that's one of the reasons that a mother may start services with us. Another reason is if they have other children and maybe they had a difficult time parenting those children or bonding with the child. The services are really specific once the child is born to helping with a positive and healthy bonding and attachment relationship between the mother and child.
Okay. Crystal, I heard you say mm-hmm. that sometimes the parents have mental issues themselves. Do you, mm-hmm. are you saying that mental illness is hereditary?
Some definitely do have a link with genetics. Not all, but some. Usually those that have been found to be triggered by things in the brain or within the body, so like depression, bipolar, some of the psychotic symptoms and things of that nature. So pretty much with mental illness, a lot of things will be one or the other. It could be that there's a genetic link and the person is predisposition to experience mental illness. And a lot of times it may be situational things or life experiences and trauma that brings on a mental illness. Sometimes it could be that they're predisposed, but a life event is the trigger that brings on the symptoms.
Okay. I also heard you say that if the parent had mental health issues themselves and they become pregnant, then they're not allowed to take their medication?
Not exactly that.
Okay.
Some medications, and I'll give a good example. There's a medication that individuals, I happen to have a hypothyroid problem, and that medication, which is for a physical illness, thing that they tell me, you know, if you want to become pregnant, you would have to stop this medication ahead of time. So there are just medications that for various reasons, whether it's a mental illness or a physical health illness, that they really recommend you do not take during pregnancy, or it could interfere with someone becoming pregnant. So it's mostly a precaution. There are other medications, some medications that an individual can take to treat mental illness that are fine to be taken during pregnancy and any other time during life. So it's important to distinguish, to clarify that it's not because it's a medication for mental illness. It's just a potential side effect like any other medication someone may be taking.
Okay, so I understand you to say that the parent is allowed to take some medication, but maybe say theirs is too strong or something. So they're allowed to take one that's not as strong for the health of the child.
I don't think it's really related to the dosage. It's more related to the medication itself and what the side effects are on the body. So those recommendations come from a doctor, the same way it would from any other. So some people are prescribed medications for mental illness and mental illness symptoms from a primary care physician or an internal doctor, and some see a psychiatrist. So it would be the doctor's recommendation and that person's specific case that you know, will inform them of whether or not they can continue their medication or whether there need to be any changes. But it's not typically the dosage. It's usually what the medication does to the body and how it affects someone.
Okay, because this can potentially harm the child. And the child may or may not be mentally ill?
I wouldn't even say that it may impact the child and they may be mentally ill. What I'm saying is that medications affect the body, and just like there are side effects to any, for certain side effects, you would not want a person taking them. It could,
right.
A side effect could be a physical, you know, side effect. It could be an intellectual side effect. And it's probably more related to those two than I would even suggest a mental illness. It's probably more of a physical or intellectual piece.
Okay. So when are children typically identified as having mental issues?
Most of the time, it's noticed once they start school. You know, when a child is at home and in the home environment and sort of like their safe place, they know what to expect on a day-to-day basis. They know all of the people who they're around. It's usually when they start school and they're in a new environment, they have less control over the environment that they're in, if we're coming and going, where you would start to see behaviors that you may not have seen beforehand.
Okay. And that's when they are referred to you by school personnel? Is that it?
Sometimes it's the parent who notices that, you know, since my child has been in school, I've noticed that they're having a more difficult time going to school. You know, maybe they're having meltdowns or tantrums going to school. They may be fighting with their classmates in school or fighting more with their siblings at home. They may notice a difference. And this is a little, it's going to sound a little surprising, but even a child who's in preschool or kindergarten could experience sadness and depression. So they could, a parent may even realize, I've noticed that they just don't seem like themselves since they started school. So sometimes the referrals are coming from the parents. Sometimes it is because of the school personnel. Sometimes parents share with a physician, you know, with the child's doctor what they're seeing in them, and the physician may refer them.
Okay. I have a question from Sheila online, and she asks, do you promote children taking medication for mental health issues?
Promote is a strong word. What I can certainly say is that there are some mental illnesses that definitely show that the child is more successful with medication, with the treatment of medication. I want to caution that most of the time that isn't the only mechanism that should be using to, you know, to treat a child. Usually they're still in therapy and they're progressing and learning behaviors and changes in behaviors that they can adjust to try to function better, as well as the parent learning other things. So I wouldn't say promote, but most of the children who are not seeing enough of a significant improvement with the traditional therapy, you know, and seeing a therapist, they could be recommended to see a psychiatrist who forms, you know, they sort of do several things. One of the things is just to offer treatment recommendations. So that definitely just goes back to, again, it's sort of like, I guess I'll use this as an example. It's sort of like if an adult or a child is diagnosed with a medical condition and the doctor says, if you do these things behaviorally, maybe exercise more, maybe lose weight, then your blood pressure will go down. You'll feel much healthier. But if you don't do those things, or even after you do those things, you don't see enough improvement, and for safety reasons and because you want a better lifestyle, then medication will be considered. It's pretty much the same thing with psychiatric medications. You try something, you know, without them in the beginning, if things are not so severe that you need medication immediately. And if you're not responding or if you need a little bit more assistance, then medication could be introduced as an option for treatment.
Okay. Would you think that medication child would have anything to do with a long-term issue, saying if it's a female, and
mm-hmm.
or it could be a male, do mm-hmm. you think that if they started taking medication, that may somehow, if the girl or, you know, young girl were to get pregnant, the medication might have an effect with her child being ill or no? I'm not sure. I was just wondering about that. Would it have any long-term mm-hmm. effects? Because, you know, medication does have a lot of side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if one of the side effects from the mom taking medication for a while, would she have an issue if her child were to maybe be born, I don't know, having seizures or, you know, something mm-hmm. like that?
That's
I don't
not
advocate
anything that
medication.
I am a...
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not an advocate of medication in young people.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be an extreme condition for me but I'm just asking a question.
Right. No, I understand. If that's not something that we have seen or that there is any research showing that to be true. So I wouldn't say so. Again, it goes back to being under the advice of a doctor, and the doctor, you know, being very patient friendly and talking to the person about how they're feeling with the medication, what are your side effects, is it working for you, the same as it would be for any other health concern, you know. But that's not something I have ever heard of being any research or experiences, even personally, in our work that I've seen occur.
Well, maybe now that children up until they're 21, it may be that you might be able to see some different types of things in the children. We're going to have to take a break right now, but when we come back, you mentioned that moms might have noticed behaviors that their children exhibit. I'm kind of curious as to what those behaviors may be. So when we get back, can you explain some of those behaviors to us? And now we'll go to break.
Of course.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Autism affects 1 in 68 children, sweeping all racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups. Autism is a lifelong brain disorder that leads to untold challenges to the physical, financial, and social well-being of people with autism and their families. Resources are stretched thin. The Autism Alliance of Michigan, a collective voice for families across the entire state, uses resources to help families battle challenges right here, right now. If you or anyone you know needs help navigating the autism journey, contact the Autism Alliance of Michigan today, 877-463-AAOM, or visit them online at aaomi.org.
Question: if you write a book, everybody will rush out to buy it. Obvious answer, no. If you were a celebrity or if you had a huge marketing budget, then maybe you can get a lot of exposure for your book. Another solution would be to check out JoeyTweets.com. JoeyTweets.com is a promotion and marketing service with access to over 1/3 of a million followers on Twitter. JoeyTweets.com has 3 packages available to fit any budget. That's JoeyTweets.com. JoeyTweets.com. Get some serious exposure for your books.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jenny White, and I am the author of the Junior Rabbit series. I have a question for you. What are you giving to that special little someone in your life for Christmas? I have a suggestion. Why not choose a book or books from the series? There's a surprise for Junior and Looney the Loon and the Littered Lake. And coming out this month is Junior Rabbit Learns About Christmas. You may call 989-906-1689 if you would like a special message written with your little one's name in the book, with some of the proceeds benefiting the Ronald McDonald House Charities. Or you may go to my website, www.jennysreadingcorner.com. We're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White.
And now we're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White. The number to call if you're streaming online is 646-668-8485. And press the 1 if you have a question or you'd like to make a comment. Before you give me those behaviors, though, Crystal, I have another question from Allie. And she's in Beech Grove, Indiana, and she would like to know, how does autism affect the brain?
Hi, Allie. That's really a good question for a psychiatrist in terms of how does it affect the brain. But I can say that what we see in behaviors is that a lot of children who have autism are delayed in meeting some of their developmental milestones. So they may not start crawling, walking, talking at the age that they are expected to. They usually have difficulty with social interaction, eye contact, building relationships, and things of that nature. But in terms of the function of the brain and how it impacts, that would be something more in the psychiatric and medical side. So I can't really give you valid information related to that. I'm sorry.
Okay, Allie, I hope that answered your question. Now, Crystal, I'd like to know, what are some of the behaviors that the mental illness in children that they exhibit?
Mm-hmm. So like I was explaining, with the child who just starts school and the parent starts to notice a change in their behavior as they've started school, the most significant thing to note is the number one sign of somebody experiencing mental health challenges is a significant change in their behavior, whether it's a child, an adolescent, or an adult. If you see a significant change in someone's behavior and you're used to them and comfortable with them, the first thing you want to start doing is just checking in with them to see, you know, what might be going on. Other behaviors that you see in young children, of course, hyperactivity. And we're not saying, you know, that children shouldn't have energy. We expect them to. But if their hyperactivity is getting in the way of them being able to perform at an age-appropriate behavior. So in younger children in class, you know, maybe they can't sit through the reading of the book. You know, they have to get up, or they're really fidgety. Along with that is the impulsive behavior. So they have a hard time playing organized games with other children. So that can cause friction in peer relationships. It could cause accidents. Sometimes we see that some of our children who are struggling with impulsivity, they may actually unintentionally do harm to themselves and others. Nothing significant mostly, but we notice that behavior. They may actually be annoying to their peers or siblings because they're unable to self-regulate and interact with them at an age-appropriate level. Poor academic performance. So, you know, you don't have a concern that the child has any intellectual delays, but at the same time there's something interfering with them to being able to perform at a expected level academically. So they have the intellectual capacity to do well in school, but you're seeing that that's not showing in their grades. I could go on. I mean, there's a lot. That's the younger children.
Okay. Do you find where there might be some bullying with these children or no?
Meaning that they are bullies at times?
Yes. Yes. Would that be one of the behaviors?
I can't say. What I can say is that bullying oftentimes does come from a child who is experiencing something themselves. You know, it may be insecurity. It may be that they are aggressive in their behavior. So those can be signs of something as well. I think that I don't know that the two go hand in hand, but most of the time children are bullying because they're acting out for some reason, and that some reason could potentially be mental illness, and at other times it may not be.
Okay. So that would some of these behaviors would go along with mood changes. Do you find that the child may be depressed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Younger children, like I said, it sounds a little bit sad when you say it aloud, but younger children do experience depression. We see it, of course, a lot more in children who have a history of trauma. So children who have had any significant loss in their lives, like a parent, anyone important to them. It could be a parent, it could be a friend, it could be any relative or a family friend even who they felt really attached to. A child who is living in a home where they're exposed to domestic violence. Of course, a child who has been physically or sexually abused or have been exposed to it. And then other times, children may just have a difficult time transitioning in life, so any major change in life. It could be a family relocating. It could be a child going to a new school. But they may not, quote-unquote, bounce back when they get to this new environment. So usually if you see a mood change in a child, and it lasts for about 2 weeks or more, then you want to start looking into what it may be. A lot of times depression presents physically first. You know, you may have a child who starts to complain about headaches or stomach aches. You see a change in their eating habits, their sleeping habits, and then that's when you definitely want to check into what may be going on with them.
Have you ever run into any of the children that may or may not have been exposed to alcohol or drugs of any kind?
Absolutely. We see children who, some of our referrals, I should say this.
I'm sorry?
In the child welfare. Some of the children who are referred to us. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. So some of the children who are referred to us may be a part of the child welfare system of care as well, which means that they have either been investigated or removed from the home because of abuse or neglect. Those families do tend to have a high population in which the child has been exposed to drugs or the parent has been using drugs, and they do tend to exhibit, it could be mental health issues, it could be emotional issues, just the separation from the parent. Sometimes they have been born addicted to drugs because of the parent's use when they were pregnant with them. So we definitely see children who have experienced that.
So in the classroom, they don't necessarily associate or socialize with their peers?
Actually, a lot of children who have been exposed to drug use during pregnancy tend to exhibit more of the behaviors that I described, like the hyperactivity, the impulsive behavior, maybe poor academics, difficulty staying organized. And sometimes their behavior looks defiant, like it looks like they're not following the rules or listening to the teacher, but it really is like a self-regulation issue where they're unable to control their impulses and sit still and, you know, maintain what's expected of them in the classroom.
Okay. So I have a question about children wearing bracelets, like persons who have diabetes or heart disease or something like that, they want them identified. What do you think about that?
Like a medical alert bracelet?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, that sounds like a good idea in terms of, it sounds like a good idea for us, like for those looking on, seeing the child, to be able to say, oh, okay, I understand. The major concern is the stigma that's still attached to mental illness and what that perception would give the general community about that child. Like if they have on a bracelet that acknowledges that they have ADHD or depression or anxiety, how would others react to that? So I get what you're saying. Like let's make it known that, you know, we may have to, I don't know, handle this child with care. But because of the stigma attached to mental illness, I don't know if it would do more good or more harm to that child.
That's a very valid point. I was thinking about this little 5-year-old child who had autism that wandered away from the school, about a month ago? And they were saying they were going to put some type of tracking device on him. I don't know what they were, you know, planning. I guess it couldn't be anything like LoJack. I mean, well, what would you put on a 5-year-old to be able to track them? You can't chip them. I don't know.
Hopefully not.
I don't know. What do you say? Yeah, well, I don't know.
And so I've heard
some people say
that
coming down the pike.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
But,
you know, I guess when you talk about a child with autism, I do think that that's a little bit different because you're talking about safety risks. So that to me does fall more in alignment with the child who has an allergy, and we need to make it known that this child cannot have peanuts. So if you want, if you have a child who you know because of whatever symptoms they have, they may put themselves at risk of harm or danger, like wandering away from the school or home, then I think that, you know, I understand that a little bit more because it can, it could potentially save their lives if someone could look at that child and see that they may be in need of help.
Yeah, that's a real bad situation, and you don't want a child molester to run mm-hmm. into a child like that and see the bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole situation is just kind of disturbing.
It is.
So
it is. We talk a lot about, you know, just how to keep children safe. Even it's different, but it's the same risk there. So even our children who are impulsive, you know, they may run out of the home trying to get away from whatever they're trying to get away from, and the parent has to try to track them down and keep them safe. And then when you think about the older children, the youth and adolescents who run out of the home in their defiance, they're still putting themselves at risk and in danger. So it's definitely what I would like to see happen, and what I'm always talking about, is the community becoming more aware of what mental illness looks like in real life versus what they think it looks like on TV and what they've read in a book and how they think it's not very common, but it really is. You know, most of us know someone who has or has who currently is experiencing or has experienced a mental illness in the past. So it's very, very common. So it's about us all sort of understanding that and not stigmatizing the person or looking at them differently or treating them poorly that would really benefit us all.
So how do you think that you would be able to do that for the community at large? I mean, you know, we need to know. So how would you go about informing all of us so we would know? That's kind of, I don't know, what do you think?
It's a large job. What we talk about, like most of the people who we work with at my job are also people who are caring for children in a professional manner. Like they have jobs where they have elected to take care of children. And, you know, of course, some of them have their own children as well. But they already know and understand that there are things that will impact a child's functioning and emotions and mood and behaviors. So what we need to do is move beyond those walls. Like we need to get into the community and into those places where there are not other professionals working with children and help them see how, I won't say common, how common, not how normal, but how common it is for children to experience mental illness, what types of things actually impact them, and how to keep them safe, you know, mostly. But, yeah, I think it's just moving beyond the professionals. So we do a lot of things where, you know, there's a community health fair and people are there to, you know, just get resources. We'll go set up shop there.
Okay.
So we're just trying to do a little bit more of that.
Do you have videos that you might be able to show that might help the community
when we go out to the places you're saying, or something that we can share?
Yes.
We have resources that we can use in that manner. There's a lot of things that we do. It usually depends on what we're going for, but what I typically find is that even seeing a video creates this detachment because that's still someone on that screen and who they can't necessarily relate to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we will show it to show like behaviors, signs and symptoms, some people giving, you know, their testimonies of their lived experience of what's going on. But I think that what takes us a little bit further is the dialogue that we have about it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, my friends would tell you, I'll talk about mental illness. I can put it in any conversation that we're having because, you know, I just want people to be more aware.
Right. Okay, I see we have a caller online. There's a Jennifer. Do you have a question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for Dr. Coleman. Dr. Coleman, well, actually two questions. The first question is this. Are there any peer-reviewed studies of how diet can affect mental illness? If you have less of, let's say, more less processed foods, more natural foods, stuff like that, are there any peer reviews to support these claims that if you change your diet, you can change your mental health?
Mm-hmm. So to be fair, let me correct you and just say that I'm not Dr. Coleman because I don't want someone to hear this and say, she's not a doctor. I am a psychologist, but so just to be fair, let me put that out there. There are not any scientific studies that support that. I know that there are a lot of things that suggest it could impact or help in some ways, you know, based on your diet. But there's nothing from a mental health perspective or the scientific arena that really shows any significant improvement based on diet. There have been some studies that suggest that some foods may or may not be helpful for children who experience autism, but there's mm-hmm. nothing strong supporting that at the same level, especially as treatment and socializing and training and therapy or anything of that nature.
So basically just like having that intervention on a more, organic level, like therapy and social interaction, stuff like that is what really helps, not necessarily diet. That kind of makes sense because someone said like their child became autism free when she took gluten out of his diet, and because I mean if that's all it took, I'm sure a lot of people do that, you know. But I mean, I'm all for it,
yeah.
But there's nothing to prove that. My next question was, and it was just something you were saying about, you know, mental health and how it can be possibly hereditary. You know, it's a case by case thing. When it comes to that, can a mental health issue be copied? Like the child doesn't have a mental health issue because he's around, let's say, his parent who has a mental issue, and he or she just does what their parent does. Can it be learned, and then can that give the false impression that a child has mental illness? And
that's a great question.
Yes, okay. It is.
So that's a great question, and the answer is yes, children mimic behaviors that they see. Absolutely. It could be a parent. It could be a sibling. However, I have to say that we as professionals look out for that. It is a part of our assessment process to determine whether this child is exhibiting behaviors that are genuinely showing signs and symptoms of them having a mental illness or if they're mimicking the behavior. Now, it's unlikely that a child will take on those behaviors just by mimicking someone and they sustain where they would need therapy, but you definitely do see that in some children.
Okay,
thank
Jennifer.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay, thank you. I had another question, but I know we got – okay, thank you. Thank you.
Jennifer, ask your question.
Well, my question was like, okay, so like, and this, I'm only going to use myself for example. Like when I was growing up, my mom used to watch like the same movie over and over again for like a long time, right? And then my dad would just go downstairs and he got tired of it. And so now I find myself doing the exact same thing. Like I like to watch a movie and I could watch it over and over and over again until maybe like, I mean, like seriously, like 6 months, not like in a row, but just like when I come home from work or whatever. I'll put on that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so that doesn't necessarily mean that I have a mental illness. That just means that I'm just copying my mom, right? I mean, my husband thinks like something's wrong with me, you know what I'm saying? So like, I just want to kind of, you know, get some reassurance. Not reassurance, because yeah. if I do have one, fine, you know. But, you know, that's why I asked the question about can it be learned, and, you know, was that mental illness or just a quirk? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me say this. When it comes to mental illness, I like to describe it as being a spectrum, right? You have some people who have what we would consider mild mental illness, you have moderate, and you have severe. The point at which we begin to look at mental illness is when someone's behavior is interfering with their ability to basically live a happy, healthy, productive life. So there are plenty of people walking around with all types of symptoms or, you know, different behaviors, you know, and maybe even some mental illness symptoms. But that doesn't mean that they need treatment, medication, or anything. It's just when, because, you know, we all develop coping mechanisms. We all learn how to deal with our behavior. So any isolated behavior would not likely suggest mental illness. It definitely is a spectrum. And when someone has a mental illness, it's typically not one behavior or symptom you're seeing. It's going to be multiple ones, right?
Okay, I don't know, you know, he made me feel all, like, self-conscious about it, you know, so I was just wondering, and it's probably stupid, but I just wanted to know. So I really appreciate you taking my question. Thank you.
No problem at all. I'm glad you called in.
And thank you, Jennifer, for calling. Right now we have to take a break, but when we come back, Crystal, I want you to kind of tell us a little bit about children who have mental illnesses. How they do they hear voices or see things or do they have thoughts of suicide or murder maybe? So when we come back, can you kind of elaborate on that with us? Right now, we have to take a break. And if you're streaming live on the internet, you may call us if you have a question or would like to make a comment at 646-668-8485. Now we'll take a break.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Is your food bland and you want to spice it up? Does it taste like something is missing? What's missing is my seasoning, Butch's Bodacious Seasoning. All-purpose seasoning, good on absolutely everything but ice cream. I'm Linda Porter, President and CEO of Butch's Bodacious Seasoning. To get the spice back in your life, call me at 313-393-2738. You won't regret.
Autism affects 1 in 68 children, sweeping all racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups. Autism is a lifelong brain disorder that leads to untold challenges to the physical, financial, and social well-being of people with autism and their families. Resources are stretched thin. The Autism Alliance of Michigan, a collective voice for families across the entire state, uses resources to help families battle challenges right here, right now. If you or anyone you know needs help navigating the autism journey, contact the Autism Alliance of Michigan today, 877-463-AAOM, or visit them online at aaomi.org.
Are you a reader looking for more compelling Christian fiction? Maybe something a little more edgy or a bit more real? Are you tired of most Christian fiction shying away from the truth and settling for a rose-tinted view of the world and its issues? Or are you an author who has a compelling story to tell, but you're afraid it doesn't jive with today's brand of Christian or secular fiction? Are you tired of Christian publishers telling you that your content is too edgy? Or maybe you've tried submitting your content under the radar to secular publishers, only to be told your themes are a bit too religious? We invite you to take a look at the Crossover Alliance. We are an online publishing company that specializes in edgy Christian speculative fiction with Christian themes and real-world content. Our company is formed from authors and readers just like you who are breaking into the mainstream and Christian markets with this compelling genre. Head over to the www.thecrossoveralliance.com for all the details on who we are, what we do, and what we accept. Right now, if you sign up for our email newsletter, you'll receive a free digital copy of our first short story anthology. Check us out today and help us spread the word about the Crossover Alliance, where light shines brighter in the darkness.
We're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White.
Yes, we're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White. My name is Jenny White, and I'd like to say if you're streaming online, you may call in if you have a question or you would like to make a comment at 646-668-8485. Right now, I'd also like to let you know we have other shows that also are on WPJC Media, and those are Marriage Playbook, The Right Stuff, W-R-I-T-E Stuff, The Parker J. Cole Show, and Dovetails, along with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White. So you may check the media for any of these shows that you might be interested in watching or listening to. So, Crystal, we're back to the question that I wanted to ask you about the suicide. I've heard you say that it is the third leading cause of death in children from 10 to 14.
Correct. Unfortunately, we have certainly seen a rise in suicide amongst children over the past 5 years or so, and it usually is something that most people, a lot of people who experience depression, severe depression, have thoughts of suicide or think that, you know, life, their loved ones' lives would be better without them, or that they just don't feel like going on anymore. That doesn't always lead to someone attempting suicide. So I want to be very clear about that. Like, you know, when you have someone who is significantly depressed and they talk about not wanting to be here anymore, you don't have to assume that they are going to attempt suicide. It's just sort of like that hopelessness that they're experiencing that makes them feel that way, and they really do feel that way. One of the protective factors of someone who is depressed is their loved ones letting them know how important they are in their lives and, you know, how they impact their lives on a day-to-day basis. Suicide is the very, very extreme piece of depression. And when someone really has decided that they have no other hope and they have made a decision that they definitely want to take their lives, the one thing that we say most as professionals is don't be afraid to ask someone if they're considering suicide. A lot of people have this misperception that saying it or asking someone that will give them the idea, where it's very, very clear to us and from people who have told us this, who have experienced it themselves, that if they're thinking it, you saying it is not gonna increase their likelihood of doing it. People usually feel a sense of relief being asked that, like, finally I can tell someone. People will admit it a lot of times, and that's when you're able to help them and hopefully prevent them from attempting suicide.
That's a really good point. You know, we've had a good time. I've had a good time. I've learned quite a bit from you. We only have about 10 minutes left. I was just wondering about the psychiatric response team. Can you give us a little bit about that?
So it varies by area, you know, by location and community. Some communities, because of the things that have become unfortunately normal in our communities of mass shootings, and as well as children and others committing suicide and all of those things being on the rise and violence, there are some communities who have established specific people who are trained to respond to those crises. Other communities may not have something like that. What we, again, you know how I said we need to step out of out of our service area and other people who work with children or even adults who are experiencing mental illness or caring for those individuals into other domains, that's definitely one that we need to tap into more. The way you approach a person who's experiencing a mental illness, whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, whether it is, you mentioned even before we went to a break, psychosis, where they're hearing things or seeing things, they may be paranoid. The way you approach a person could definitely impact the way they respond, and that's even if we're not experiencing a mental illness, right?
That's true.
So helping someone understand what to look for when they're responding to an emergency to determine whether or not that person may be thinking rationally, maybe whether or not they feel threatened or if they're exhibiting signs that they may have a mental illness, and how to engage them to hopefully de-escalate the situation instead of adding to their frustration or anxiety or whatever the case may be, is pivotal to us decreasing the amount of people who we're losing when first responders arrive to a scene and the person is experiencing mental health illness.
Okay. Do you have any communication going between you and your organization and law enforcement?
We have done some. It's really difficult to engage different from an administrative level, I'll put it that way. I believe the first responders would be very open to it, but, you know, we can't just walk into a police station and say, hey, guys, we have a training for you. What we are very fortunate to have in our area where our agency is located in Midtown Detroit is that we've actually built a really good relationship with Wayne State Police, which is, for those of you who are not from this area, community university. And they're located very close to us. So instead of calling our Detroit Police Department, which is much larger and typically responding to crime type activity, we call Wayne State Police. And so we've been able to build a good relationship with them. And usually when we're calling them, we're calling from our crisis care center. So it is a place where children come and present if they're experiencing a mental health crisis. And sometimes we do need to have them hospitalized. So that's who we reach out to. They've built a relationship with us. They have a conversation with the child to help them understand what's about to happen, where they're going to take them, why they need to get in the car, and things of that nature. So we've started there, and we've seen a significant improvement in the response time of people coming there. And like I said, being comfortable and interacting with the children once they arrive. So we're hoping definitely over the next couple of years, because it is a long-term plan, to start reaching out more to the Detroit Police Department and other local communities as well.
Well, you know what, Crystal? I've had a great time talking to you and listening to you, and I've learned quite a bit that I didn't know. I'd just like to ask you, we have 5 minutes. Is there something that you would like to tell our audience before you go?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The term that I always use is check in with people. You know, we're a very busy community, and, you know, our lifestyles are very fast-paced. But when you notice that someone in your life has changed, please check in with them. You have no idea the impact that that could have just by, instead of saying, how's your day going, and, you know, continuing to walk, really wait to see what they're going to say and respond appropriately. So that's for us looking out for one another. And the other thing is for us looking out for ourselves to not be afraid to seek help. If you have insurance, your private insurance, you call your insurance card, you let them know that you need to see a therapist who is covered under, who is contracted with their insurance. If you have government or public insurance, you could call your state or county. Most systems are set up to provide services and have coverage for you. So my key thing is to check in with others and then check in with yourself and take care of yourself.
Well, that's great. Crystal, I really have had a great time with you, and I thank you so much for coming on the show. And maybe
thank you. I appreciate
I can call on you again.
Of course.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Crystal.
Thank you.
I just, one thing that I would like to say about the suicide piece that Crystal mentioned, I had a young lady in my Sunday school class last week who told me she had a very good friend who committed suicide. This was because she was depressed. She had become increasingly depressed over the course of weeks, but she shared with my student what her intentions were. And, of course, she tried to talk her out of it. But anytime we lose young people, it's a tragedy because someone always asks, what could I have done? Or if I had, I could have done anything to change their mind. Student said she tried to talk her out of it repeatedly, but the young lady didn't listen. She opened a window and jumped out of it to her death. Things are always changing. We have to understand that one day is good, another one is not so good. Like the old saying, what a difference a day makes. Families, during this Christmas season, when you all get together, talk to your young people. Make eye contact with them. Don't allow them to bring their cell phones to the table. Ask them what's going on with them. Adults, they need your expertise. Look at them in the eye. Make them look back at you. Show them you're concerned about them. After dinner, play games. Go bowling. Anything. Just do that family time. And if you must, tape the game and you can watch it later. All young people want is the love and attention of the adults around them. Laugh with, have fun with them. You can teach them things, but you can also learn from them too. This is Jenny White saying thanks for listening. And to those of you that called in to ask questions or you made a comment, I thank you. Until next week, love up on a young person. Good night.